Good morning. Well, actually, good day. This is Debbie. I am new to reading the Decatur Herald Review, and today is Wednesday, June 17th, 2015. Starting with firefighters. Area firefighters sharpen skills in Argenta. Hiding in a woman's restroom, Aspen Belcher said the radio chatter in the hallway frightened her, even though she knew the building like the back of her hand. It was scary, she said. Belcher did what she was told, though. However, after firefighters found her, Captain Mark Kaufman of the Cisco Fire Protection District instructed her to stay low because of heavy smoke. The 18-year-old crawled out of the ground floor restroom at Argenta Oriana High School, a place she'd been many times before graduating last spring. Minutes later, Lieutenant Tim Stemple and firefighter Cody Hildebrand of the Cerro Gordo Fire Protection District emerged carrying 9-year-old Gracelyn LeBeau, who was found on the ground floor and lying under a desk. The girl showed evidence of burns, but not the kind you might expect. She'd gotten plenty of sun swimming at the Southside Country Club earlier that day. I was pretending I'd gotten too much smoke in my lungs, Gracelyn said. Indeed, the smoke reported at 6:35 p.m. Monday on the second floor of Argenta Oriana High School was nothing more than a large-scale fire drill involving 5 rural fire protection districts, the Macon County Sheriff's Office, Decatur Ambulance Service, and Decatur Salvation Army. Corey White, chief of the Argenta Oriana District, said Captain Doug Kirk proposed the exercise as a way to be better prepared should disaster ever strike one of the fire district's largest buildings. High school principal Sean German said he and other officials thought it was a good way for the schools to return the favor to firefighters who supervise the homecoming bonfire and assist with fire drills. We're blessed and fortunate to have such a great group of volunteers in our communities, German said. Once the Argenta Oriana Fire Protection District obtained permission from the school board and the necessary insurance coverage, White invited Hickory Point, Maroa, Cisco, and Cerro Gordo Fire Districts to join in. The others got to the scene within 12 minutes after Argenta Oriana's arrival at 6:42 p.m. Hickory Point Fire Protection immediately deployed its ladder truck at the northeast corner of the building, but firefighters took none of the 5 buildings found on the second floor out that way because it was raining. Argenta Oriana Battalion Chief Steve LeBeau and Derek Miller also set up their command post inside the high school's north door, something they would not have done in a real emergency. We'd be outside getting soaked, Miller said. However, an attempt to charge the hose after firefighters strung it up to the second floor offered an unexpected splash of realism. Cut the water, LeBeau shouted after the attempt began. It's leaking too much. Excess water on lower floors is a natural byproduct of real-life firefighting on upper levels. LeBeau sent in 4 search and rescue teams in all, the first from Argenta Oriana, the second and third from Cisco, and fourth from Cerro Gordo. Other firefighters fought the quote, fire, unquote, under the command of Miller, who pronounced the flames suppressed at 7:20, shortly before rescuers retrieved the last victim. Argenta Oriana Fire Cadet Carson Holsoppel from Classroom 205, where the fire was to have originated. Cleanup, which involved a fair amount of mopping, wrapped up by 8 p.m. White said he was more than pleased with how well the drill went. Our only downfall was having too many radio channels going, he said. Cisco's Kaufman confided that if the fire had been real, any firefighter would have dragged Belcher on the floor to get her out of the restroom, even though she was wearing shorts. That might not have been too comfortable, but it had been faster, said Kaufman, who added, I think it's just awesome to get all the local departments together like this. We should do it more often. End of that article. News from the Herald and Review. Decatur's Township Quadrennial Assessment goes smoothly. The Decatur Township's Assessor's Office has successfully completed its quadrennial think that's right, quadrennial assessment. Decatur Township has turned its assessments of the 26,608 parcels of property in its jurisdiction to the Macon County Supervisor of Assessments. The assessments are used to set property tax levels. "We got a value on everything, and hopefully they're good," said Township Assessor Vicki Sheets. By law, township assessors are required to view every property in their jurisdiction once every 4 years. Assessors will make more individual changes this year with deeper neighborhood-by-neighborhood analyses of property values performed later. Residents can view the assessment of their properties by going to the assessor's website at DecaturTownshipAssessor.com. If owners are unhappy with their assessments, Sheets encourages them to contact her office at 428-3479, 428-3479. Owners can also appeal the assessment to the Macon County Board of Review. Homeowners often challenge their assessments to try to lower the amount of taxes they pay. Tax rates can increase when the value of properties decline in order to allow local governments to collect at least the same amount of money as they did previously. The only way for most homeowners to see smaller tax bills is for governments to request fewer property tax dollars or for there to be enough new development to provide additional property tax revenue. The township has kept the tax levy level for the past few years, which has led to a slight increase in the property tax rate, though officials could not provide an exact amount the rate changed. It's a far cry from the dysfunction of the previous township quadrennial. Due to a variety of issues between township officials over the office's budget, Macon County had to come in and complete the quadrennial. Because of an intergovernmental agreement with the county, the township was only billed $4,851, which is a quarter of what the work cost. If the county had had to do the township's assessment again, the township would have been billed for half the work. Sheets said the past year and a half has seen her office improve, and she's hopeful future assessments can go more smoothly. The work continues. The mess was 30 years in the making. Teen tells of abuse at the hands of Anthony L. Maben. Decatur, let's see, this is from Rachel Rogers and her Herald and Review staff. Decatur, during testimony lasting about 2 hours on Tuesday, a teenage girl told the jury of multiple incidents in which a 46-year-old man allegedly raped her through the summer of 2012. She testified the first instance of sexual assault occurred on July 4th when Anthony L. Maben, with whom she was acquainted, took her to a hotel room. She said she did not know why they were there. "I was thinking, why is he doing this to me?" she testified. "I fought to get him off, but he hurt me." Getting to the end of the article, Colleen Barnell, an emergency care physician at St. Mary's Hospital, testified that the rape kit of the victim was collected on August 30th, but the amount of time that had elapsed from the last alleged incident was too long to collect possible semen, and the victim's darker skin made past physical trauma difficult to detect. The trial resumed at 9:30 this morning, Wednesday the 16th. Continuing on here, Mount Zion School Board defends drug tests. Rachel Rogers again and the H&R staff. Mount Zion defends drug tests. About 100 parents, students, and community members crowded into the Mount Zion School Board meeting on Monday looking for answers about the district's new random drug testing policy scheduled to begin in the fall. The board approved the policy at its meeting on May 4th, and it extends to all Mount Zion High School students wishing to participate in extracurricular activities that are organized and sponsored by the district, including sports, clubs, driving and parking at the school, as well as attending dances, banquets, and the graduation ceremony. "We have kids doing drugs in our school, and our current system is not deterring them," board member Jeffrey Sam said. Several parents voiced concern regarding their children's privacy, the cost of testing, the policy's inclusion of non-competitive activities, and the community members' lack of involvement or notification of the measure prior to its approval. Many called for the board to withdraw the policy. Parent Arnie Jeffers said the policy would cause more problems than good, and parent Gary Geisler said the decision requires more study to determine whether it's needed and if it would be in the best course of action by the district. School district attorney Barney Mundorf said there does not need to be evidence of an extensive drug problem in the school for the district to enact the policy, and it was approved for the purpose of being a deterrent for students who might abuse alcohol and other drugs. About 150 students would be tested each year. Superintendent Travis Roundcoat said, and the district would cover the cost of all initial tests for students. The district will pay about $25 per test, and certified technicians from Decatur Memorial Hospital will collect the samples and send them to a MedTox drug testing lab. For all other tests or retests, the students and parents would be responsible for the total of about $275, which is about 11 times the district rate. Debbie Acchiavati, administrative director for corporate health at DMH, said transporting the samples to a lab that is certified to test them becomes expensive. The expense also comes from freezing the sample for 2 years as mandated by law. One parent asked whether students who decided not to consent to random drug testing would be barred from attending sporting events as spectators. Mundorf said the policy would not apply to public events. Participation is a privilege. Observing a public event is a right, he said, and added the policy would not affect a student's ability to go to school to receive a public education. That's the end of that article on drug testing in the Mount Zion schools. High school students earn role in research at Milliken. There's a picture of a person, Allison Harris, taking the temperature of silver nanoparticles while working with Perry Grimes in the Project SEED Summer Research Program at Milliken University. Taking the temperature of silver nanoparticles. Decatur. Scientific experiments conducted by high school students are typically not much more than an academic exercise. Not so with research underway this summer at Milliken University, where three economically disadvantaged high school seniors are helping create and study hollow nanoparticles, specifically clumps of silver atoms coated with clumps of gold atoms, to see if they one day can be ejected into tumors to destroy the cancer from the inside out without harming healthy tissue. Nanoparticles are apparently preferentially taken in by cancer cells and may also be useful in locating them, said Milliken's Anne Ramsberger, who was associate professor, with fellow associate professor of chemistry Paris Barnes, is overseeing the project. The American Chemical Society project, SEED Summer Research Program, awarded Milliken $7,000 in fellowship funds to involve the high school students, and the Decatur Springfield ACS chapter kicked in another $500 so that each could get $2,500 stipend for their work. Allison Harris and Perry Grimes of Eisenhower High School and Precious Dixon of MacArthur High School started last week and will work full-time in the Lady Tabor Science Center through August 7th. Milliken undergraduates also working on the project with the high school students are seniors Peter Piers of Schaumburg and Aaron Fleming of Lovington. Continuing, Harris and Grimes said they're both more interested in the biological sciences, with Harris looking at studying animal or environmental science in college. Grimes is considering a career in nursing. The trio made silver nanoparticles their first day, and on day two, the youthful researchers turned their attention to using the silver nanoparticles to former hollow gold nanoparticles. First, however, they had to let the solution containing the silver nanoparticles warm up to room temperature and added the gold-containing liquid gradually at the rate of about 16 micrometers 61 micrometers every 30 seconds to achieve the desired result. If you add the gold too quickly, it clumps with itself too much, Rammelsberger said. I hope all you listeners are catching this. You can do it at home. Harris and Grimes used a pair of micropipetters and the stopwatch function on Harris's cell phone to complete the task. My solution's starting to look bluish now, Grimes said. I'm really excited to be in the program, Harris said. I thought it would help with college. Their science teacher, Penny Dunning, who was visiting that day, told her students she was proud. I'm a cancer survivor, so I'm really happy to see you working on this, Dunning said. End of the article. So, continuing on. Next, murder trial and Cutler death begins. Decatur. In a lengthening opening statement, the state laid out its case against Chad M. Cutler on a trial for allegedly drowning his wife in their bathtub as she was proceeding with a divorce against him and he was involved with another woman. First Assistant Macon County State's Attorney Nicole Kroenke told a jury of eight men and four women that Lisa Cutler, a Spanish teacher at Eisenhower High School, told a co-worker in January 2012 that if anything happened to her, please look at my husband. She made the statement through tears, Kroenke said. 3 months later, the mother of two young children was found dead in the bathtub of her house. When Lisa Cutler, 47, made that statement, she was referring to this defendant, Kroenke said, pointing toward Cutler, 39, who was seated at the defense table. The state plans to present more than 60 witnesses, including experts on aquatic deaths and computers, to show not only that Cutler murdered his wife of 14 years, but he did so in a premeditated and planned manner. The evidence in this case will be voluminous, Kroenke said. The Cutler's marriage was troubled. She obtained an order of protection against him in February, but when he was laid off from his job later that month, she allowed him back in their house. On April 26, she contacted her divorce attorney, Kroenke said, adding that she wanted to proceed with the divorce. She was afraid of the defendant. She did not survive to see the next day. Just hours before Lisa Cutler drowned, Cutler was another woman in Fairview Park. About 12 hours after Lisa Cutler was pronounced dead, he sent a text to that woman telling her, I never felt about my ex the way I felt about you. The Cutlers were behind on mortgage payments of more than $9,000 on their house in the 2600 block of South Lake Parkway and were in debt of more than $450,000 between them. After Lisa Cutler's death, Cutler texts the other woman, with the secret life insurance, I can pay off the house and be debt-free. He invited her to move into his house with her children. That night, he tells the state police he knows nothing of the life insurance, Kroenke said. During the 5 days preceding Lisa Cutler's death, Cutler took out two accidental death policies, each payable to him as a sole beneficiary, one paying $500,000, the other $200,000. He was turned down for two additional policies applied for on April 19th and 20th, which together would have paid off the $850,000. All these insurance transactions were conducted from an email account the defendant set up in Lisa Cutler's name on April 18th, which was used exclusively for that purpose. Less than 6 hours after she was pronounced dead, Cutler made the first call to an insurance company. Calls to insurance companies continued throughout the day. Jeff Justice, Cutler's attorney, said Lisa Cutler suffered from depression and anxiety and been taking several medications, including clonazepam, the drug of choice for anxiety. As a result of possibly going off of clonazepam, Lisa Cutler could have gone into a seizure, Justice told the jurors during opening statement. The medical evidence does not show whether she fell in the bathtub or drowned after a seizure, but that is possible, Justice said. Cutler responded to finding his wife in the bathtub by pulling her out and attempting CPR, Justice said. He drained the water, then removed her from the tub, he said. Cutler was not sure what was going on later in the day. He sent a text message to the broker who was selling the house. My wife has had a near-death experience. Please don't come. Lisa Cutler was paranoid and had suicidal thoughts, Justice said, adding a psychiatrist will testify about her. She constantly felt like there was doom coming, Justice said. David Ransdell, Lisa Cutler's older brother testified the two Cutler children stayed at his house in California while Chad Cutler went on a trip. Ransdell read aloud emails which Cutler sent from Moldova, a former Soviet republic, during a wife shopping trip in July, 10 weeks after Lisa Cutler's death. He told his children he was looking for another wife and described a woman he found who might be one. An email sent on July 6, 2012 said, "I've seen Galina every day since I've been here. You need two parents to have a happy family." Brian Evans, a paramedic with Decatur Ambulance Service, testified that he noticed Lisa's neck and jaw were stiff, when he tried to open her airway. "That's a sign of rigor mortis, Evans said. He had arrived after the Mount Zion Fire Department. Heroic efforts to revive her were unproductive. "She was completely dead when we got there," Evans testified. A 9/11 call made by Cutler was played in court. Cutler told the dispatcher he went to bed, then Lisa went to the bathroom to take a bath, then he got up 3 hours later and found her. "Can I ask you some questions?" Cutler asked the dispatcher. The dispatcher said he would be right back as he dispatched the first responders. Cutler then said he had two children at home and had a request for the first responders. "Is there any chance of them coming in quietly?" Kenneth Burns, captain of the Long Creek Fire Department, testified that Cutler was standing outside the house when he arrived. His demeanor was calm. He expressed his concern about the number of people coming and the cats getting out of the house, Burns testified. End of this article on this beginning of a trial. Into fitness here locally. Piloxing gives youngsters chance to mix up fitness choice. Piloxing is spelled P-I-L-O-X-I-N-G. Sounds like Pilates and boxing to me. There's a picture of instructor Jenny Allsweed help Mariam Savan, 8, practice her punching in a piloxing class during a University of Illinois Extension 4-H and Decatur Family YMCA exercise demonstration at the YMCA on Monday afternoon. Decatur. Carly Farrar does ballet and Nicholas Farrar likes punching, so the 13-year-old twins found both something that appealed to them while trying out piloxing at the Decatur Family YMCA on Monday. The 4-H and Y teamed up to offer a 2-week fitness classes for kids aged 9 to 18 to try out karate, cardio dance, piloxing, and other classes. "This is fun because they can dabble in different areas," said Becky Hugo, the 4-H program coordinator. "Part of her job is to build community partnerships as well as create interesting programs, usually taking ideas from her two daughters. I was trying to think of something fun and entertaining for the kids," she said. "The classes are open to the public and give kids a chance to try activities they'd never be exposed to during a physical education class." The kids hesitated at first, standing back from where piloxing instructor Jenny Allsweed stood at the front of the room. She motioned them forward and explained that piloxing is a full-body exercise that combines Pilates, boxing, and dance. She then had them practice not pulling their punches by hitting her palms. "We recommend you do this in class without socks and shoes and socks for better balance," Allsweedy said. Needing no encouragement, the kids shed their footwear and for the next 45 minutes punched, stomped, stretched under her direction. They couldn't follow the choreography exactly, but they kept up with Allsweedy and the fast-paced music enough to be sweaty and a little sore by the end. "Ah, this was pretty fun," Carly said. "I'm looking forward to yoga," Nicholas said. Angela Fulke, health and wellness director at the Y, said it's important for kids to get 60 minutes of activity every day, especially during summer break. "People think the classes are all for adults. We have lots of youth classes," Fulke said. They're here to learn something new and have fun. The classes continue through January 5th. This article was written by Emily Steele, a staff writer for the Herald and Review. Olympic dream a reality. Lauren Doyle is one of the top players for the U.S. women's rugby team, which qualified for the 2016 Summer Olympics during the past weekend. This is by Alex McNamee of the Herald and Review. Long before Lauren Doyle became a star athlete, she dreamed of one day competing in the Olympics, but what she imagined at a young age is nothing like what's actually making her dream come true. (Clears throat) I didn't know what rugby was until I was 18, said Doyle, a former Meridian and Eastern Illinois standout. Even when I started playing it, I had no clue I was going to be in the Olympics. But she is, after the U.S. women's team won its side of the North America Caribbean Rugby Association's Sevens Championship this weekend to secure a trip to the 2016 Olympics in Brazil. The women's team beat Mexico, its biggest competition at the tournament, 88-0 in the final, completing a dominant run of victories, 59-0 against the Bahamas in the quarterfinals and 53-5 against Jamaica in the semifinals. The U.S. men's team also qualified in what will be the sport's return to the Olympics for the first time since 1924. It's like a dream come true, Doyle said. I always wanted to go to the Olympics since I was little. It's a great feeling. It's a relief. There's no more pressure to qualify. Doyle was a state track medalist during her senior year at Meriden, then linked up with Frank Graziano and Eastern Illinois rugby team as an outlet to continue her athletic career. She didn't think she was headed for the Olympic opportunity until Graziano, the EIU coach, introduced her to the U.S. rugby residency program 2 years into college. Then I started taking it more seriously, Doyle said. Doyle had one of three hat tricks for the U.S. team in its blowout win against Mexico. She could realize what the team was accomplishing because it dominated from start to finish. After the game, you're just sort of kind of in shock. The game was so lopsided, it became a reality pretty fast. I don't think it actually will sink in until I'm literally in Rio de Janeiro, though I'm playing with the idea that we're going to go there, but I don't know what it's going to be like at all. I literally have no clue what's going on in what I'm going to do in Rio, Doyle said. That big statue, Christ the Redeemer, where the person's holding their arms out, I'll probably go to that. Afterwards, she said her Facebook and Twitter pages were blowing up with comments and congratulatory messages. The tournament was playing in North Carolina, so she celebrated with her parents and one of her best friends from college, all in attendance. It was awesome to be able to go out to dinner and share the experience, Doyle said. If we'd automatically qualified in Amsterdam, it would have been cool because you're in Amsterdam, but here they were able to be here. I know my mom was going insane, my dad as well. That was really great. They could be there. New Zealand, Canada, Australia, and England have also clinched spots in the women's Olympic field. Doyle and her U.S. teammates will play Canada in 2 weeks at the Pan Am Games in Toronto. From now until the Olympics in August 2016, Doyle is focused on becoming more of a leader. I'm starting to become more vocal because I'm a pretty quiet person, Doyle said. I like to observe more, lead by example, but I'm working on vocalizing myself. Okay, that is the end of the article about U.S. rugby team going to Brazil in 2016. This was by Herald and Review staff writer Alex McNamee. This is the end of part one of the Decatur Herald and Review. This is Debbie, June 17th, and I will be back with part two.